This episode of the Coin World Podcast is brought to you by Amos Advantage, your ultimate destination for coin collecting accessories. Receive free shipping on orders over $65. This is a limited time offer, so shop AmosAdvantage.com today. Welcome to the Coin World Podcast. Here are your hosts, Chris Bullfinch and Jeff Stark.
Welcome to another edition of the Coin World Podcast. I'm Jeff Stark.
And I'm Chris Bullfinch.
We have a great show for you this week. We get to talk to our colleague in arms, Paul Jilks, senior editor of Coin World. We're also going to be exploring one of his favorite coin series and delving into the history of the U.S. coinage by the Philippines.
If you enjoy this episode of the podcast or you've been enjoying any previous episodes that you've listened to, please remember to keep on listening and subscribe, because every listener we get and every subscription we get, that helps us to keep doing what we love, which is recording podcasts for all of you.
Every time you subscribe, an angel gets its wings.
Or a,
something.
Or a coin collector gets to hear a little bit more about their favorite series. I don't know.
I tried. Look, I tried.
Point being, you should subscribe because it's a nice thing to do. And also, like, it's free. It costs you nothing. So.
Absolutely. So this week, now that we've implored you on that, let's talk about this week in history. I picked these because I know that they're a particular interest to myself, they're a particular interest to you, Chris, and hopefully it's something that the listeners will enjoy. On July 15th, 1920, what happened then? 99 years ago.
99 years ago, July 15th, 1920.
And then this is a double whammy because we also explore what happened the day after that, July 16th, 1920.
So 1920, I'm going to guess it was one of the centennial commemorative half-dollar releases?
Wrong.
Dang.
So 1920, July 15th, was the first official coinage by the Philippines under the U.S. administration.
Oh, Philippines. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. That's why I mentioned that at the top.
Yeah.
And then, so that was July 15th. The next day was the striking of the so-called dollar medal depicting President Woodrow Wilson. That celebrated the opening of the Manila Mint, which I think we may have mentioned in a past episode because it's
we've talked about it, I think, sort of parenthetically in regards to other things we were talking about.
Yeah. So the Manila Mint was obviously there in Manila in the Philippines. That is the only U.S. mint that was not on mainland soil. So it's part of the mint history. So that was fun. I love the series of U.S.-Philippine coinage and Douglas MacArthur on the 50 centavos and the peso. And there's all the great cool stuff that was struck during World War II with the S-mints. And anyway. So
lots of fun things. Okay, Jeff, what's their favorite snack in Manila?
Is it Spam?
No. Manila wafers.
Womp womp. Walked right into that one.
Yeah. Spam. Where did you get spam from?
Well, because Spam is popular in Hawaii.
Is it?
And I was like, maybe its popularity spread. But see,
My mom bought my older brother when he was first living on his own a Spam cookbook.
Spam.
His signature dish
Spam.
And his signature dish is fried Spam on spaghetti, and it is delicious. So anyway.
I am going to take your word for it,
because
not sound delicious
at
all.
Oh, it's so good.
So you asked me a question, which was sort of off the cuff.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you the official trivia question
this
week.
Let's hear it.
And it is a callback to the previous episode where we interviewed Heidi Wastweet.
Yes, okay.
You have a decent memory. You'll recall our wonderful discussion with the great artist, Heidi Wastweet.
I absolutely do.
So one of the things I learned while preparing for that interview was the fact I knew that she had designed Maui trade dollars, several of them, in fact.
Yeah.
So the question is, what year was the first Maui trade dollar?
I know this.
That she designed. So don't say it yet.
I know. I got two Maui trade dollars when I visited Maui many, many years ago. So they're fun coins.
You're fairly certain you know the answer.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
I think.
Well.
It's one of two things.
You're going to have to pick one. You don't get four chances.
Okay. All right,
so we'll come back to that in a bit.
We will circle back.
So you're going to talk about the barber
Yes. Done, so seriously? So apropos of our interview that you're going to be listening to later in this episode with
you
Paul
better.
Jilks. Yeah, no, stick around. It's a good one.
It's very enlightening, very fun.
No, it's great. And Paul's just a wealth of knowledge. I mean, you ask him a question and he can give you paragraphs on anything. So we're talking about Barber Dimes this week. So Barber Dimes were introduced in 1892 to replace the Seated Liberty motif, which had occupied it for just ever.
Far too long.
Seated Liberty, yes. They weren't very inspiring coins to begin with.
Well, neither are the Barber Dimes, honestly.
No, but at least it's a change. Yeah. So a
change will do you good. Some
well,
change?
It did, you know, in 1916 it did the dime good when they introduced the Mercury Dime.
Absolutely.
Or the Winged Liberty Head dime.
Beautiful coin, but anyway.
Beautiful. So the Barber coins were introduced for a number of reasons, chiefly that the Seated Liberty motif had been going for almost 60 years, more than 50, between 1837 and 1891. So those were quite stale, and they wanted to change it up. And they also wanted a coin that would wear evenly and well in circulation, because they found that silver subsidiary coinage — we're going to talk in greater depth about subsidiary coinage, which is a term that I know you guys have heard me talk about in the past. We're going to be covering that next episode. But very quickly, subsidiary coinage refers to denominations under a dollar or whatever crown size silver coin countries produce. It's centimes in France, or before the introduction of the euro, it was centimes in France, centavos, or centimos, or lots of different denominations. So fractional.
The Barber subsidiary coin.
Yes. So the Barber subsidiary coinage.
Was this made so Charles Barber could get his name on something?
That or the nation's haircutters really needed a break. Kind of free advertising. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But the Barber coinage was designed by Charles Barber, who was a very famous and long-serving mint engraver. Was chief engraver for some time at the mint. And he designed a very simple, what has been described as prosaic, which I think is a pretty good word to describe them.
Absolutely.
Silver coins, which used a kind of Roman-styled bust of Liberty on the obverse with a little tiara crown type thing that says Liberty, and it's really quite a simple design. And then a laurel wreath with one dime for the dime, the 10-cent coin, and then a sort of sickly skeletal-looking eagle on the reverse for the quarter.
That sounds so appealing.
Yeah, right? It's for the quarter and half dollar. Yeah, it really didn't look —
but anyway, we're talking about the dime.
Yes, we are talking about the dime, which is one dime within a laurel wreath is a pretty — that had been on the reverse of dimes since 1837. There had been an eagle, a very small eagle, previously for the cap bust stuff, but a laurel wreath with one dime written in it was common. So the Roman-style bust on the obverse was actually mistaken. It's meant to be a female representation of Liberty, and it was commented at the time that the portrayal was somewhat androgynous, and the coins generally were not particularly well-received, but they did circulate very heavily during their production run and after. They were, as I said earlier, they were introduced in 1892, and the series and the motif on all three denominations, the half dollar, quarter dollar, and dime, was retired in 1916 when they were —
hallelujah.
Yeah, most people were — the mint was given a mandate, was given a legislative mandate that they could only change coin designs every 25 years, and the second 25 years was up, they made haste and transferred to the Winged Liberty Head dime, the Standing Liberty Quarter, and the Walking Liberty Half Dollar, respectively, for the dime, quarter, and half dollar.
The pinnacle of U.S. circulating coin designs.
It is described broadly as the Renaissance of American coinage, and it is aptly so because it really knocked the dust off, and it made them quite a bit nicer. But the Barber Dimes are nonetheless a fun and generally accessible series. I actually have quite a few myself. You can get them circulated as high as very fine, even in junk bins. You can find them up to mid-grades for a few bucks. And they were minted at the Philadelphia, Denver, New Orleans, and San Francisco mints. So you can collect the last coins from New Orleans and the first coins from Denver, actually, within these series. And our interview guest today, our venerable colleague, Paul Jilks, this was his big area of expertise, in addition to tokens of the Ku Klux Klan, which we talked to him about a little bit later in the interview. In the interim, before the interview, we also are going to deal with a term for our Term of the Week segment that was mentioned last week and that we're going to deal with this week. And the term is rim. So we've been talking about sort of the different terms for just the physical aspects of coins, describing the proper terminology for different parts. So where you have obverse and reverse, and you have fields and devices, now you have a rim. So if you take change out of your pocket, whether it's a 1 cent coin, a penny, a nickel, whatever you take out, if you look at it, there's the design that's on the two faces. You know, in the case of a Jefferson nickel, for example, it's a, you know, portrait of Jefferson and then Monticello on the obverse, and then Monticello's on the reverse. But you'll notice that there's a part right around the edge, not the edge of a coin, like the side that is either plain or readed, which we've discussed in previous iterations of this segment, but it's a slightly raised at the very edge of the face on the obverse and reverse. Now, that little tiny raised, and it goes all the way around the coin. It's a full 360, and that's called the rim. So rims have varied in size, in a United States context at least. Rims have varied in size a little bit. There have been denticles on rims. There have not been denticles on rims. We discussed denticles a few episodes ago. And the current rims on U.S. coins are plain. There are no denticles or anything. But a coin is said to have full rims if the raised portion of the rim is fully intact. If there's a nick taken out of the rim, or if there's a dent or a little bit of material removed or some kind of damage, it's said to not have full rims. But a coin with full rims is generally more intact and often will carry a higher price than a coin that doesn't have intact rims. So you have now obverse, reverse, face, device, field, edge, and rim now. So rim describes the raised portion at the very edge of the face of the obverse and reverse, not to be confused with the edge as the third side of a coin. It is a component of the face of the obverse and reverse at the very edge, and that is the rim.
All right, that is the term of the week. Now it's time for you to think about the answer to the question I asked momentarily.
Sounds good.
Moments ago, it was, what year was the first year for Heidi Wasweet's designs for the Maui Trade Dollar?
Wait, when did Heidi Wasweet's design first appear, or when was the Maui Trade Dollar introduced?
No, the former. What year was her first design employed?
Her first design was employed in 1995? Okay, hold
no.
on.
No, it's in your lifetime, so...
1996?
No.
2000?
No.
1998?
No. Shall we keep going?
I can just keep guessing the years I've been alive for, anywhere between...
Yeah.
Anywhere between 1996 and 2019.
How about the official answer from the artist herself was 2004?
Oh, okay. 2004.
So, 15 years ago. Now, she hasn't done all of them in that time, but she has done many of them.
Oh, very cool.
And these are very affordable, under $10 in uncirculated, maybe even $2, $3, $5 a piece, depending on where you find it and all that. Beautiful island imagery.
Mm.
And
yes.
These actually have a spendable component. They were dollars initially. Now they're $2. You can spend them at certain
Absolutely.
Places on the islands. On the islands of Maui, and so that is the trivia question of the week, and it's a fun series.
Do you happen to know what other year she designed? Because I might have one of hers.
Many of them. I don't have them all.
Because the ones I have 1995, and I have 2006.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she did 2006.
Oh, cool. So, yeah, my brother and I both have examples from our trip to Maui.
Yes.
Very cool.
Perfect. That speaks to the collector mentality. You got these pieces on your travels, and they are special to you because of that. Somebody else might collect them because they want to go to Maui, or they've been to Maui, or they find the island imagery appealing.
Or they just really want to spend a whole bunch more than face value to have a coin that you can walk into a store and buy stuff with. Hey, it though. No, it's like the Brixton pound.
Many people out there, for the lack of a better word, many muggles look at coin collectors and go,
oh my
God. Why would you spend X amount of dollars on this penny, on this 5 cent coin?
Oh, no, absolutely. I love the Maya Trade Dollars. I own two of them. But oh my God, muggles is absolutely the perfect term to describe people who aren't involved in the coin collecting hobby. That is, because I was calling them the numismatically uninitiated, but that was a bit of a mouthful. So
yes.
Muggles. Oh my God, I love that.
Muggles.
So
we had a great time talking with Paul about the collector mentality, about his collecting journey, his time as a numismatic journalist. We found the interview enlightening. There's some news buried in there. You'll have to listen closely, but we hope you enjoy it. Here it is.
Amos Advantage is a proud sponsor of the Coin World podcast. Whether you're looking for numismatic books, storage, or cleaning supplies, Amos Advantage has you covered. Visit amosadvantage.com today. And now, back to the show.
And today we are joined by a special guest, a fellow from just down the hall, senior editor Paul Jilks, who marks more than 31 years on the Coin World staff. We are privileged to get to talk to Paul about his numismatic career, his time before Coin World, and his past collecting experiences. Thank you for joining us today, Paul.
Thanks, Jeff.
So, to start off, you weren't always a numismatic reporter. You worked for some time as a local reporter in Florida and Pennsylvania, is that right?
Correct. Before I started at CoinWorld in March of 1988, I had spent 12 years with weekly newspapers as well as daily newspapers. My most recent assignment before I started at CoinWorld was covering courts, the police, fire, ambulance, you name it. That was in Pennsylvania. My first job actually was in the Pittsburgh area, working for a weekly chain of newspapers where I got paid 25 cents per column inch. That means however wide the column was and however deep it was, for every inch I got paid 25 cents. So the more I wrote, the more I got paid. I don't know how that would work out today because I write an awful lot for CoinWorld now in all facets of the hobby.
So if you're getting paid by the inch now, you'd probably be making pretty good money.
Probably decent, yes, yes.
So through your time in Pennsylvania and Florida, you covered the Ku Klux Klan briefly in Florida in the late 1970s, correct?
Correct.
And from that, you got into collecting Klan tokens, or you acquired a collection of Klan tokens. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I did that while I was here, and of course I got really strange people looking at me kind of strange when I was collecting the items. But the county that I'd lived in Florida, which was Polk County, about 40 miles southwest of Orlando, the Florida Grand Dragon, who was the lead or top state officer in the state of Florida, was in the county that I was in. So like every other weekend, it seemed like in Lakeland, Florida, they would have a parade or gathering or protest, whatever you want to call, of the Klansmen in their robes. In one of the little communities that I covered as a staff reporter for the Winter Haven Daily News Chief, was in a little town of about 2,000 people. And it was pretty eye-opening when you see 150 robed Klansmen show up at a little town council meeting. And the night before, somebody had burned a cross on the front lawn of one of the residents in town who was protesting the town council supporting a police officer that had discharged his weapon in the black community.
So what drew you to the area of Klan tokens and memorabilia?
It was just strictly the history behind it. There was one gentleman that I became friends with from the American Political Items Collectors, a gentleman by the name of Ken Broyles. Ken has probably had the most extensive collection of Klan memorabilia, period. I just focused on the tokens or the numismatic angle. He collected everything.
So I know that today there are many fake items or items that are purported to have come from the Klan that actually are modern fantasies. What was the landscape like that back in the 70s and 80s?
As far as trying to collect those pieces?
Well, how many did you encounter a lot of counterfeits when you were collecting these?
I only started collecting, you know, post 1988. So when I came here at CoinWorld, I couldn't tell you the exact year that I began collecting or coming across them. I was doing research in a library on something totally unrelated and came across a pamphlet that was put out in 1977 and then redone, updated in 1981 by a gentleman by the name of D.E. Birdsell that gave a catalog of different genuine as well as known counterfeit or fantasy pieces. And I went looking for some of the pieces that they listed as genuine. I ended up eventually selling off most of those pieces. I still retained one, which was a good for token, good for 5 cents, whatever, just as a relic of that time frame.
After your experience reporting in Florida and Pennsylvania and all these places, how is it that you came to CoinWorld? Did something interest you about numismatic reporting, or was it more of, you know, a reporting job?
I was just looking for a change of pace. I first started collecting coins when I was about 8 years old, pulling stuff out of circulation when silver was still prevalent. I had no mentor, growing up, neither of my parents collected coins. Nobody in my family collected coins. My dad worked in newspaper circulation for the Long Island newspaper Newsday, and I would go with him on Saturdays when the newspaper carriers would come in and pay all their bills, and the adult supervisors for them would have to count all that money. I got the opportunity to go through a lot of that stuff and pull out stuff and replace it with other cash so that their accounts were balanced. But I could fill holes in my Whitman folders for, you know, cents, nickels, dimes, quarters. One of the best pieces I came across, can't remember the date, but it was a well-worn trade dollar that I got for a dollar that somebody had used to help pay their newspaper bill.
That's awesome. I think there are a lot of collectors who share similar stories, not only the parallels of starting young, but being involved from the newspaper setting. So how did that interest early on develop into what was your main focus, which was barber dimes?
Well, even just coming here to Coin World, I had never seen a copy of Coin World, an actual printed edition, until I came here for my interview and was offered a position on staff. They were mainly looking at that time for somebody that had expertise in searching court documents. And during the 80s, late 80s, investigations into the Federal Trade Commission was hot and heavy on the coin market.
It seems that your 12 years as a reporter, especially chasing all the serious news stories, really laid a great foundation for doing some of your work here.
It did. It helped quite a bit. I learned that the best way to do is to more or less network. I know the first time I went to a coin show was the 1988 American Numismatic Association convention just down the road in Cincinnati, introducing myself around to different people. And then I made it a point that any subsequent show I went to, I would seek out those people that I met at the previous show and then add a few more folks on there and so on and so on. So every subsequent show, I've gotten to know a heck of a lot of people in the industry.
Yeah, like everyone, practically.
Well, I've gotten to know that, based on different assignments that I would get to cover different things, if I don't know the information, I pretty much know who I can go to get it and who's got the inside scoop on something.
What are the greatest differences you notice between numismatic reporting and, local reporting, local crime reporting, the whole range of things that you did before Coin World? What's the greatest difference? I imagine a lot of the principles of reporting are sort of the same, cultivating sources, chasing the story is similar. What are the greatest differences that you see between those two types of reporting?
Detail. I know collectors, or sometimes you can hear them referred to as coin weenies. They want to know every nuance, every possible thing that you can think of about a coin.
That's what we should have called this podcast, Coin Weenies. That would have been a
okay,
way better
How a particular coin was struck, how the thing was made, out of what materials, striking pressures, the different types of dies, how the dies were made. The job that I've had has afforded me, and covering the U.S. Mint this entire time, has allowed me the opportunity to travel to all the different mint facilities. I've been inside each one of them, been able to document some of the main coin releases from the U.S. Mint, including most of the bullion issues, the first platinum coins from 1997, the American Buffalo coins from 2006. I did the Apollo 11, it was one of the more recent ones. Been to the San Francisco Mint, been inside the Denver Mint, been inside the Philadelphia Mint multiple times, and the West Point Mint.
Between all of the different presidential administrations and mint directors and interim mint directors, have you noticed any sort of guiding philosophy or principle that has sort of animated the mint's decisions and Congress's decisions as well? Because Congress obviously has the foremost authority in terms of deciding what coins get produced. But have you noticed significant changes in mint policy and attitudes and things like that?
I think it all comes from the top. Each of the mint directors I've dealt with over the years have had their own, I wouldn't call it necessarily agenda, but they've got, things that they know has to be achieved, not only coin-wise, but people-wise. It's like a business. It's basically one of the world's largest machine shops. So they got to know all about having to deal with OSHA and different regulations, workplace regulations, equal employment opportunity, different stuff like that. So there's so many behind-the-scenes issues that a lot of people don't realize that the mint director has to deal with, not just what's the next coin set that's going to come out or be offered to collectors.
That really makes a nice segue to what I'm wondering about, and I think the listeners might want to know is, you know, in your 31 plus years, you've covered just a bevy of stories, big news, small news, everything in between. Like you say, you've been to all these unveiling ceremonies and gotten great imagery from the Mint production. But I think the one that sticks out to me as probably the most important for the hobby, certainly the one that causes the most interest, is the saga of the 1933 Double Eagle. Can you walk through how that was, chasing that story when it was discovered with Stephen Fenton and all that, to the modern day?
Well, there was a lot of different legal issues. So I was getting fed, through my sources, I was getting fed different information, court cases, different stuff through the Mint's archives about not only production of those coins, but other, possibly clandestine issues in addition to the 33 Double Eagle, which was intended as a regular issue. I pretty much covered that story from 1995, I believe, 1995 or 1996 when the thing surfaced. It surfaced in the hands of a British dealer, Stephen Fenton from Knightbridge Coins. In 1996, he and a coin dealer from Lee's Summit, Missouri, Jay Perino, were in New York making a deal to sell the piece. And unfortunately, both of the gentlemen ended up getting arrested by the U.S. Secret Service at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The coin was seized, and that began the long saga of covering. I mean, I was covering that story just about every week, anytime that there was a new nuance to that, until the coin, the U.S. Mint decided to make a settlement in January of 2001, near the end of the month, like 4 days before the case was supposed to go to trial, over ownership of the coin, who should get possession of it. And luckily during that time, at the time that coin was being stored on the ninth floor of the World Trade Center, I think it was Tower 2, where the Secret Service had their New York headquarters. That coin was eventually moved from there, I believe, from there to West Point, and then eventually possibly to Mint headquarters, and then eventually made its way to down to Fort Knox in Kentucky and was stored there. Had it not been moved at the time that it was moved, it could have been in the rubble from the September 11th terrorist attacks.
And you've obviously covered the modern story as well, along with CoinWorld editor-at-large Steve Roach, the surfacing of the Langbord family pieces.
Correct.
And you've also done significant research and work regarding other pieces that may or may not still be out there.
Correct. And I'm still getting stonewalled from the Mint. I was trying to find out who actually turned in the last piece. It was turned in supposedly by a private collector. I ended up making it a point to go to the Pennsylvania Association of Numismatists convention last year. I believe it was like May 10th. They had a banquet that I was invited to. The speaker was Greg Weinman, who was the lead attorney at the U.S. Mint covering, dealing with the 33 Double Eagle. He was presenting a lot of neat new information about it. And he mentioned that the Mint had another coin on radar that was in the United States. And I followed up checking into, well, are you going to go after that coin? And I was told no. Hadn't dawned on me that the reason why they weren't going after it was that they already had it in hand. I've been being frustrated trying to find out when it was turned in, which coin it was, because it's a possibility it's a piece that's known. It was known throughout the years by other dealers that had seen this particular piece. And it's a question if we found out that this was a piece that had been circulating through the numismatic community back in the 1980s.
That's mic drop type stuff right there, Paul.
I've been able to track down who I believe it is, and I've contacted that individual, and of course didn't expect to get anything back, and haven't.
That's awesome.
So we have a developing story now that we can.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is we're breaking news here, sort of. Thanks for chiming in with that. That's everybody loves this story, and it's the story that will never end, apparently.
they already did a movie about the never ending story. Yeah.
So what other signature events? I mean, that seems to have really defined your career, but that's not all you've done. You've done many other things. What other story jumps to mind as of significance?
Well, I had mentioned a little bit earlier that I dealt with the Apollo 11 coins, you know, the curved coins. I had the opportunity to go for the launch of the actual ceremonial first strike ceremony at the Philadelphia Mint. Got to meet the offspring of the three Apollo astronauts, including Mark Armstrong, Neil Armstrong's son. And that's a tie into another story that I had covered back in 2002, I believe it was. Went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for the launch of the 2002 Ohio Quarter Dollar, and had the opportunity to meet Mark's dad, the actual astronaut, Neil Armstrong. One of the interesting things about that whole event, one of the premier astronauts of our era, John Glenn, was also there, and Neil Armstrong wouldn't even autograph an item, a book that John Glenn wanted to get him to autograph.
wouldn't even give an autograph fellow to his
fellow astronaut. Yeah,
that's funny.
Now, Armstrong's a notoriously tough get.
He's
signature.
He's tough because he's like a lot of the celebrities that autograph stuff. They're concerned that it's going to be just automatically peddled, and that's the only reason why people want it.
Well, it's an understandable concern, but of all of the stories that you've covered, what kind of story do you find engages you the most? Do you like going to the unveilings and sort of meeting all these interesting people like Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin? Do you enjoy kind of chasing the story about who submitted, you know, this coin, for example, or do you enjoy auction reporting? Which of those genres of articles, which engage you the most and which do you enjoy writing?
Some of the neat ones is how some collectors come across a coin, find it in there, whether they found it in circulation, whether they were handed a bunch of coins as a kid, you know, by their grandmother or by some other family member. And it turns out that what they have is a super rarity. There's been some of those have come up. I think there was a 1983 wrong planchet error Lincoln cent. There was another one, was a 1943 copper that popped up that somebody had in a family collection. Suspected it might be genuine, but weren't sure.
And those are certainly, I think, most popular with Coin World readers. So
they always like the stuff. It's like buried treasure or shipwreck stuff. I've covered probably just as long as the 33 Double Eagle is the SS Central America. I've covered that since I did all the court cases from the late 80s when they first found the treasure and first started bringing it up. All the legalities to get it to market, all the stuff dealing with Dwight Manley's efforts to acquire all of the treasure, where they took some of the worst-looking ingots or whatever, melted that stuff down and made relic metals, gold metals, using U.S. coin designs as the basis for the dyes. Neat stuff like, and I went out for that strike ceremony there that they had out at the Presidio in San Francisco.
That would have been awesome.
Very cool.
And of course, the bar that was stolen from Dwight's garage.
Yeah, that was interesting. You know, that a piece got taken while he was, you know, in the process of moving from one house to another.
Jeez.
You know, you have it a happened. Huge collection of if you just a gold bar just disappears,
and you're like, oh, am I missing something here? That's funny. So, having covered the hobby now for 30-plus years, what changes have you noticed in the collector community, in the market, in the way that coins are sold? And based on your experience, where do you think it's going next?
Well, I've noticed, you know, it used to be, and I mean, this is a tough thing that all numismatic publications, anybody that deals with advertising and stuff like that, the way how dealers advertise their coins, for the longest time when I first came here, the big thing was either fixed price lists or product listings, you know, where a dealer would get so many coins and they would just take a full page ad out just listing every single coin that they had for sale. And if you were a collector, it was a hit or miss whether or not you could get a chance to buy that particular coin, because somebody else may have already purchased that particular piece. Nowadays, the big thing, and if you want to say blame this, it's an advantage but a negative depending on what side of the coin, literally what side of the coin you're on. Back in 1997, when the advent of the internet, now you've got more coins where a coin dealer maybe, say, comes across a fancy collection, maybe even help put together that collection. He may get first dibs at being able to buy that whole collection outright from a collector. He may go make arrangements to get a premium or get a commission for selling the collection piecemeal or consigning it to an auction and letting the auction company do all the work of describing, illustrating those coins and selling them that way. So I know in those instances, more or less, you've got the auction companies have more or less non-paid consignment directors. Every dealer that has a collection that's going to be offering it in an auction, you know, they didn't have to go and expend money to go get it. It came to them. So you're seeing a lot more of that and less people doing listing ads. That's how I see it. I mean, the prices are going crazy, and a lot of the stuff that it's going crazy on is a lot of modern, not only the old rarities, and the old rarities, once something's rare, it's always rare. If it's a population one, it ain't going to get any less than that.
Well, unless China makes another, but thankfully
We're talking genuine.
I know. So you've touched upon it a little bit, but the really bifurcation of the market, the stratification. So, you know, at the top end, that's all well and good. We just saw a top pop modern winged Liberty Head dime go for crazy money. We see, you know, Coin World reports on some of these stories all the time as registry set folks are building sets and all that. But how has the bottom, the base of the pyramid changed in your 31 years? It seems that that's the most important element that gets lost in the day-to-day headlines of rarities.
It's hard to introduce. I mean, this is if anybody could have the magic formula, how do you introduce new people to the hobby? I found that if you collect something, you have to have the collector mentality. I don't know if you can go and teach that to somebody. You just have an innate ability that you like to collect stuff that somebody else doesn't necessarily have, and you want to get it in the best condition possible. And most cases, you may collect other stuff. You may, you know, like I went from collecting barber dimes and collecting some coins. You know, I still look for different stuff here and there. But my focus went to, I was collecting autographs from people that were on the television show, The Andy Griffith Show. Many of the people that I've had the opportunity to meet at different cast reunions for the past 25 years. I still have my hands in that for a little bit. But now I go to a lot of, you know, living the dream of going to a lot of rock concerts, meeting a lot of the classic rock musicians that were part of my youth. And I think that's part of what a lot of us end up doing. It brings back memories, and we relive, keeps us young.
So is there any hope for your two children? You talk about planting the collector gene. Your two children, you took them to shows. Many folks in the hobby encountered them for years. That did not stick.
No, that didn't stick. And, you know, you either got the, you know, I don't know if they have the interest in the history. I noticed, you know, the young collectors that I encounter at shows or have encountered at shows, those that have the interest in history overall will be enamored with coins. Coins provide, you know, they've got great stories to tell. Each one has something to tell regardless of what condition it is, who produced it. It's just neat stuff to deal with. I learn something new every day.
And that is, I think, what I like best about this job. Can't speak for Chris, but
I definitely echo those sentiments.
So we, all three of us here in this room, love coins and love telling their stories. We look forward to reading more of the stories that you share with the Coin World readers. So thanks for being here, Paul. This has been great.
Okay, thank you.
So wasn't that some big news from Paul Jokes in the interview? Everybody loves the 1933 Double Eagle. We love talking with Paul about that. We hope you enjoyed it as well. If you did, or even if you didn't, you need to subscribe to the Coin World Podcast. Yeah. We're going to keep delivering this kind of fun stuff every week as long as you're subscribing.
So until next week, happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next week. Send us your questions and feedback on Facebook at facebook.com/coinworld or on Twitter at coinworld. Be the first to know about our next episode by signing up for our newsletter. Go to coinworld.com and click on free newsletter to sign up today. This episode of the Coin World Podcast was brought to you by Amos Advantage. your ultimate destination for coin collecting accessories. Receive free shipping on all orders over $65. This is a limited time offer, so shop AmosAdvantage.com today.